You're listening to local and regional news here on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. A loophole that's benefited Tesla for around a decade is ending in Washington state. KUOW's Scott Greenstone has more.
In recent years, Washington electric car buyers have been starting to branch out from buying Teslas. Even though buying from electric car makers like Rivian or Lucid is harder, you have to go out of state or buy online.
Washingtonians have been, you know, by their behavior, by their voting with their pocketbooks, voting with their feet, purchasing these vehicles and bringing them here.
State Senator Marco Elias, a Democrat, passed a bill last week closing a loophole Tesla secured in 2014 when it was the main name in the electric car game. That loophole keeps Rivian and Lucid from selling here. You can go into Rivian's showroom in Seattle, but you can't buy any cars there or discuss financing. In about 3 months, when this bill goes into effect, you can walk in and buy a car just like in a Tesla dealership. I'm Scott Greenstone in Seattle.
Some relief could be coming for rural Washington homeowners who have seen higher insurance premiums because of increased wildfires. As Spokane Public Radio's Steve Jackson reports, the organization that helps insurance companies assess the fire risk has modified the criteria for determining threat levels.
The Washington State Fire Chiefs Association petitioned the Washington State Ratings Bureau to allow more consideration of firefighting capability into determining insurance rates for homes. The Ratings Bureau has mostly relied on distance to fire stations without taking into account the actual firefighting ability of local departments. Now, homes up to 7 miles away from a manned, full-time fire station with a mobile water supply will be eligible for reduced premiums. The Chiefs Association says those stations are more effective than the Bureau previously believed. Stevens County District 1 Fire Chief Mike Busey says previously homes had to be within 5 miles of a station.
I think it was estimated statewide that it's now 98% of the homes that are covered by this, as opposed to before it was like 88% or something like that.
Busey cautions that the new designation is for manned stations only, not all volunteer departments, which often take longer to respond to fires. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
Years after contracting COVID-19, Latino farm workers in Washington state are searching for answers as to why their health is not returning to normal. Spokane Public Radio's rural affairs reporter and Murrow News fellow Monica Carrillo Casas has more.
During the blueberry harvest in Oregon in 2021, Baldomero Munoz was working another long day in the fields when he started feeling dizzy. Munoz kept working, thinking it would pass, but the next day, he felt worse. A few days later, Munoz tested positive for COVID-19. The 75-year-old says even though it's been 5 years since his initial diagnosis, he continues to deal with symptoms on a daily basis.
To this date, my legs feel weak. I can't run anymore, and for about 3 seconds, I forget where I am.
Munoz believes he has long COVID. Researchers and physicians describe long COVID as a condition where the patient continues to feel lasting symptoms despite testing negative. In a study conducted by the University of Washington Latino Center for Health, about 41% of agricultural workers reported experiencing symptoms of long COVID. Leo Morales, one of the lead researchers, says it could be that many were late to access the vaccine.
There is a certain strain of skepticism and, I would say, misinformation that flows through the Latino community that, yeah, people are hesitant to do it. The vaccine will give you the disease. You know, that's one concern.
Munoz began picking strawberries in the Oregon fields in 1994 and then went back and forth between Oregon and Washington to pick grapes and blueberries. While the work is hard, he says his love for the fields has only grown. He says he often sings the day away during busy seasons. His commitment to the fields didn't change when he first got COVID. At the time, Munoz says he didn't realize how serious his symptoms were. He remembers thinking it was a cold creeping up on him. Or maybe he was working too quickly and it was causing him to feel dizzy. But after testing positive, Munoz realized he wasn't well enough to be on his own. So he drove to his daughter's house in Vancouver. A few days later, Muñoz says he called her at work, feeling like he was on the verge of death.
Llegó y me llevó al médico rápido.
She arrived and took me to the hospital, but I remember what hurt the most was my head. I felt like my head was about to explode, and little by little, my lungs felt like they were failing me.
He says he didn't work for several months due to pulmonary issues. Even now, he deals with lingering symptoms of weak muscles and respiratory problems. Farm workers Lorena Avalos and her husband Jose Leon tell of a similar experience. Leon says he was a healthy man who rarely got sick. Even during the first year of the pandemic, he says he didn't get COVID. He even got vaccinated. But 2 years ago, he contracted it and wound up in the hospital.
Caí al hospital, me pusieron también para respirar.
When I went to the hospital, they put a ventilator on me to help me breathe. I was given an inhaler afterward and use it 3 times a week, but I ended up in the hospital again a month later.
Leon says doctors diagnosed him with asthma, and later he developed pneumonia. The lasting effects, he says, have been brutal on his health.
I'm scared I'll end up in the hospital again, he says.
At their dining room table, his wife, Lorena Avalos, fidgets with an inhaler as she talks about testing positive for the virus 5 times. She has struggled with breathing problems since her first infection 4 years ago. The first time I got COVID was 3 months after getting the first vaccine. And then I tested positive again 5 months after. I was getting COVID every few months. Avalos and Leon now rely on inhalers to manage their lasting symptoms at a significant cost. Because the couple doesn't have health insurance, they pay out of pocket for every inhaler they buy, each about $120.
The minute I run out, I go and get another one.
Leon is also still paying his hospitalization bills. The Washington State Institute for Public Policies estimates at least 39% of farm workers don't have medical insurance. Last year, a bill was introduced in the legislature to address health coverage equity, recognizing that immigrants, including many farm workers, are disproportionately uninsured. The bill would have expanded access for people excluded from federal programs, but it didn't pass and it wasn't heard this year. If another pandemic comes around, there has to be a plan B. For now, workers like Muñoz, Avalos, and Leon are left managing their symptoms on their own. Amónica Carrillo Casas, reporting.
Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Department. If you have a news tip or story idea, email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. That's all from us today, but stay tuned. This Week in Water is coming up next, followed by the American Democracy Minute. You're listening to KMUN.
Water as a weapon of war. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The U.S. and Israeli war against Iran is creating deep concern over drinking water supplies in the Middle East.
Major urban areas in the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea rely on desalination plants that remove salt from seawater to produce fresh water, and almost all of those facilities run on energy generated from fossil fuels.
A few of these desal plants have become targets of bombs, drones, and missile strikes by the combatants. About 10 days ago, Iran accused the U.S. of damaging a desalination facility that supplies 30 villages. A spokesperson for the U.S. denied that allegation.
Then Iran allegedly damaged a desalination plant in Bahrain. Analysts worry that it's the culmination of a long-feared scenario in the Middle East in which water becomes a weapon of war.
Michael Christopher Lowe, director of Utah University's Middle East Center, wrote in The Conversation that while the Gulf's monarchies are often described as petrostates, he calls them saltwater kingdoms, superpowers in the production of fresh water from the sea.
Facilities that supply drinking water are theoretically protected under international law, but U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth said that the American forces will not follow any, quote, stupid rules of engagement.
Mohammed Mahmoud of the UN told the New York Times that it's absolutely a war crime to attack infrastructure that civilians depend on by either side.
Before the war started, Iran had already been suffering from water shortages caused by drought, climate change, mismanagement of infrastructure, and overuse by agriculture.
Last year, the capital city of Tehran, with its 10 million inhabitants, had little rain and its reservoirs were stressed.
But last weekend, what has been described as black rain fell on the city. It was oil-soaked rain caused by fires producing smoke clouds following airstrikes by the U.S. and Israel on oil depots, according to CNN.
Euronews reports that the plumes of toxic contamination likely contained precursors to acid rain and carcinogenic compounds from the burning hydrocarbons. Residents were urged to stay indoors.
Long-term health risks from the smoke include neurological and heart conditions, birth complications, and cancer.
The pollutants can stay on buildings and get into waterways, affecting ecosystems for a long time.
Iran has attempted to close the Strait of Hormuz to prevent oil tankers from moving through the region, which has sent gas prices soaring. That's making people look to buy electric vehicles and install solar panels.
If demand grows, despite the Trump administration killing the rebates and incentives put in place under Biden, it will require more lithium for car batteries and energy storage.
Although EVs and renewables have lower environmental impacts, harvesting lithium, whether through open-pit mines or brine ponds, can deplete fresh water, pollute ecosystems with toxic chemicals, and release greenhouse gases.
A team of researchers at Rice University might have found a win-win solution. They are using toxic PFAS compounds, also known as forever chemicals, to extract lithium from briny water. The compounds are destroyed in the process, solving two problems at once.
PFAS substances are everywhere, in our water, in our air, and us, because they're used in so many products, from cookware to waterproof clothing and food packaging. Studies have linked them to liver damage, reproductive disorders, immune system disruption, and certain cancers.
Activated carbon is used to remove PFAS from water. But as James Tour of Rice University told H2O Radio, the carbon is often thrown in the garbage, and the PFAS ends up in the environment again.
So Tour and his team decided to turn that trash into treasure. In their study, they took PFAS-saturated carbon and mixed it with brine. They then flash-heated the mixture, which produced lithium fluoride.
Tour and his team tested their lithium fluoride in batteries, and they showed increased stability and performance.
They say their approach uses less energy and water than the two most common methods to extract lithium from brine, and they say it will likely have lower operating costs and be faster, taking only a few minutes rather than months to complete. And finally, do you know your warblers from your sparrows, finches from flycatchers? If so, your brain is likely aging well.
That's the conclusion of a new Canadian study which looked at the brains of birdwatchers and found that expert birders had more structurally compact areas related to attention and perception than the rest of us who might only recognize a duck from a seagull.
Birding requires a keen eye and strong memory, but as we age, our brain structure becomes less complex. The team says that birdwatching can build neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to change, reorganize, and grow neural networks.
The study used MRIs to track how water moved through brain tissue to determine its density. Denser areas are associated with working memory, spatial awareness, and object recognition.
They found that expert birders had denser tissue compared with novices, even though they were roughly the same age.
That doesn't mean birders will avoid cognitive decline, but it might happen more slowly, giving new meaning to the word bird brain.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. When asked in January about his 2020 threat of having the National Guard seize voting machines, President Trump told the New York Times, "Well, I should have. There are signs of such authoritarian action in the 2026 midterm." We recently reported that a former Trump January 6th election lawyer and current special White House employee, Kurt Olson, was behind the Fulton County, Georgia ballot seizure. ProPublica reported February 28th that Olson and other 2020 Trump allies met in Washington, where a draft national emergency order implementing federal election rules was discussed. Trump's DOJ has also now sued 29 states to compel them to turn over their voter and election data. Courts denied DOJ in California, Oregon, and Michigan cases, but States News reported March 13th that DOJ is appealing those cases, arguing the security and sanctity of midterm elections in those states would be questioned without federal control of the lists. The courts so far have made it clear that the states, not the president or his administration, control elections, and most constitutional scholars agree that applies to emergencies too. But the Fulton County ballot seizure case, executed without an emergency, is still pending, leaving the door open to other potential federal interference in November. We'll be watching. We have links to our Midterm Madness series at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
You're listening to KMUN.